We're moving on today to start to look at the rites, the tantric rites. So what they are is using colour and ritual to transform our lives. Basically, that in a way, that's what magic is. It's the use of ritual, the use of certain ritualized action to transform our lives, and for the good or otherwise. But of course, in tantric rites, they're used to cultivate certain qualities. And in this context, they're rites that we can use within friendship to transform friendship, and in a way, the kind of actions that we might need to take, or the certain qualities that arise, certain forces that arise in friendship. So the first one that we're going to explore today is the white rite of pacification. So that's Shanti Karman. Shanti, you might remember, is the Sanskrit for peace. So making peace. Now, it's interesting because I think peace is something that can be very underrated in our society, particularly in Buddhism. We like to think of kind of passion and vitality, but sometimes I think the actual ideal of peace is underrated. In the seminar on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Sangharakshita talks about why the peaceful figures in the vision of the bardo after death, and the visions that arise after death in the space between death and rebirth, the peaceful deities come first. Sorry, the wrathful deities come first, and the peaceful deities come afterwards. And he said he thinks that's because, in a funny kind of way, the wrathful energies are what we're more used to experiencing, and we're less used to experiencing peace. So in a funny kind of way, peace is more frightening to us, which is just something to reflect on. Do we find peace as an ideal less accessible or even more challenging to us? The Buddha was a great bringer of peace, and he used this rite quite often. If you read the scriptures about the life of the Buddha, he used the sort of means of making peace quite a lot. There's a very famous story of which you might be familiar with, of Yasa, who was a young man who lived in a palace, and he was a bit he was a bit of a lad, and he enjoyed parties. And he had the means, he was from a wealthy family, so he had the means for quite lavish parties. And if you remember, he wakes up in the early hours of the morning after a particularly lavish party and sees a vision all around him of all his friends and of all the people who've been to the party, all the people playing music and everything sort of slumped in a heap. And you might be familiar with this particular image in a slightly different context. If you've all had the high spirits of the night before, and then you wake up in the early hours of the morning, or even late hours of the morning, and you look around you, and it's a scene of sort of carnage, and you think, who is that person? And it's quite graphically described in the Buddhist scriptures of dribbling and snoring and all the rest of it. Anyway. Yasa has a moment of complete revulsion and runs out of the palace saying, this is frightening, this is horrible. And in a way, we mustn't get too stuck on that particular vision. I think what's happening is at some point we might have a vision of samsara, of the sort of horror of samsara, perhaps the horror of violence, or the horror of living a life solely for pleasure. And it comes to you in a different way. For Yasa, it definitely came in after this party. But I think for all of us, it's a sort of vision of we have of, oh, this is samsara, and it's frightening and it's horrible. And Yasa at this point goes running out of the palace, and he comes to the grove where the Buddha is staying, a sort of parkland where the Buddha is staying. And the Buddha has just woken up, or after his evening of meditation and sleeping, and he's mindfully walking up and down in the early morning sun. Very peaceful, very still. And Yasa runs and he says, it's frightening, it's horrible. And the Buddha turns to him and he says, this is not frightening. This is not horrible. And it's that moment when we see the sort of horrors of violence or unskillful mental states or a life lived without meaning. And we see a vision of something else that's possible, a vision of peace. This is not frightening. This is not horrible. And I often bring that to mind if I'm in a particularly turbulent mental state, coming back to meditation. This is not frightening. This is not horrible. It's a vision of peace and stillness, of groundedness. And I think that's what we're looking for in this rite of pacification, of purification even. The other vision that we have of friendship living in peace, which I wanted to bring in on this retreat, particularly because it's a story that's very familiar to the Buddhafield team, the Aniruddhas. Actually, it's a bit unfair because the Aniruddhas is actually just, there was Aniruddha and two of his friends, which we now just call the Aniruddhas. It's a bit like saying, calling the Theravada local community the Karanadis. Actually, we might as well. Nice. Maybe we should. The Vajratharas, the Karanadis. Anyway, so the Aniruddhas, which was Aniruddha and his friends. So there were three of them living in, again, in the outside, in some parkland. And the story goes that the Buddha, there was a big quarrel in Kasambia, and the Buddha had gone to try and sort it out. You want me to wait? Plane's just flying over our head. Anyway, carry on. So the Buddha, the Aniruddha and his friends are living in this parkland, and the Buddha has been at Kasambia, and there was a massive disharmony in Kasambia, and it was all over what side of the toilet the water pot should be left. And the Buddha said they were stabbing each other with verbal daggers. No one could be convinced. No one would be back down, you know. And he tried. He just couldn't get through to them. And he actually just left at that point. The only thing that sorted out the Kasambians was when the laity said they weren't going to feed them anymore unless they sorted it out. So even the Buddha couldn't get them to be in harmony again. So he left. He went wandering through the forest. He met an elephant. That's another story. And finally he came to Aniruddha and his friends, and I think he just wanted to experience what the spiritual community could look like, to be with the followers, the renunciants, who were actually living in peace. And they said to him, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And I think that was deeply nourishing to the Buddha in some ways, to be with that kind of community. And I'll just read out the way they did that, because I think it's very apt to where we are now. In fact, they weren't doing anything a lot different than what we're doing this week. Satchamuni's nodding, so I'm hoping this is all very familiar to the Buddhafield community. Venerable sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery, or drops it into the water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech, but every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dharma. Mm-hmm. It's lovely, isn't it? It's a lovely, very simple way of taking each other into account and living in peace. And the Buddha said it's a great gain and happiness, and it's for your long-term welfare and happiness to bring the Aniruddhas to mind with a confident heart. Whoever does that will in a way take on the flavour of the Aniruddhas. So let us all remember the Aniruddhas, or Aniruddha and his friends. So that's the first thing we do in friendship, is bringing peace, bringing harmony, and bringing that sense of beauty that's like sunlight reflected on snow, or the lotus, the white lotus emerging from the water, or the full moon arising through, appearing through the clouds as the clouds part on a clear night, or like the wood anemone or snowdrops that appear in the first signs of spring and the first signs of summer. I love that moment, actually, particularly the wood anemone. They're like little white stars, or the wild garlic in the woodland that pokes up, yes, like white stars, so beautiful against the green. So it's that kind of purity that comes up. And often it springs up even through difficulty, that sense of purity. There's a lovely quote from Wisdom Beyond Words where Sangharakshita says, "The Buddha's knowledge was not a cold, analytical knowledge. He saw with warmth, he saw with beauty, he saw all beings as shupa, which also means pure and beautiful." So, yes, the Buddha saw with feeling, with warmth, seeing all beings as pure and as beautiful, shupa. That's the kind of white right that we're evoking. So what are we purifying? Well, we're purifying or pacifying the unskillfulness that arises in friendship. So I'm sure this has even come up in your first group yesterday, that within friendship, it's inevitable that at some point we will encounter difficulty. There's a creation myth from the Indian tradition, which is that when the world was created, yes, we mustn't take it too literally, because the Buddha didn't think the world was created in a moment. But anyway, it's a myth, so don't take it too literally. But the gods all went around and they started to stir the milk of the universe. And they stirred the milk of the universe and all these wonderful things came out, like the wish-fulfilling jewel and the cow of plenty. And you can tell it's India with a cow of plenty. Beautiful jewels and silks and colours and trees and plants, rivers and lakes and seas and all the wonderful creatures that live in the sea and all the wonderful creatures that live on the earth. And more beautiful things emerged. And when all these beautiful things emerged, the last thing to emerge was the poison at the root of it all. And all the gods went, "Ugh!" and ran away, except for sometimes it's Avalokiteshvara, sometimes it's Vajrapani, but we'll come back to that later. But in a way, I think it's a myth of friendship. At the beginning of friendship, we might have a sense of beauty in all the good things. We're very generous to each other. Lovely things emerge. And then at the bottom of that, if you start stirring up the depths, up comes the sort of scum at the bottom, really, of this big barrel of the milk of the universe. And this is what happens when we need to deal with that, the things that we don't like about each other. Things emerge, and in a way it's a good thing. Sangharakshita says that friendship is very useful to us because we only know ourselves in relation to others. And there's many stories about this in the Paikan. I've got to stop selling so many stories. I'll tell you that another time. But well, the beginning, there's a sutta about metta. And it starts off with this woman who's really, really, she's renowned for being so generous and metaful and having such a great meditation practice. And, you know, everyone loves her and thinks she's wonderful. But the maid servant really knows what's going on. So the maid servant decides to test her. So she gets out of bed later and later. And at first the woman shouts at her. And then eventually it gets to the point that the woman races down the street after her with a frying pan trying to hit her on the head. And basically the Buddha's point is we only know the metta that we've really generated until it's tested. Mm-hmm. Until we're in relationship to others. And all those stories about, you know, people going off onto long solitary retreats and then coming back and shouting at someone because they burnt the curry, you know. So, yes, we only know ourselves in relation to others. And in Sri Ratna, we have a particular way of doing friendship, which is quite involved and intimate and direct, and it will stir things up. Things come to the surface that would have remained hidden. Think about this idea, because sometimes we talk about safe spaces, and safe spaces in, say, you know, places like Thi Ratna Loka or Buddhafield, and in a sense, that's true in one way, because I hope that we're all making a commitment to practice the precepts in relation to each other. But in another way, it's not a safe space, in the sense that things emerge that are uncomfortable and difficult, and conflicts do arise. Well, we've heard, even for the Buddha, conflict arose in Kasambia, and there wasn't even a lot the Buddha could do about it. This is the nature of spiritual community. We can't have a spiritual community and just take out conflict. Mm. And the reason that we can't do that is because there's a particular process of mind that emerges in friendship, where we start to expose each other's what are called anusayas, or latent tendencies. So in this process, what happens is you've got latent tendencies, and the latent tendencies that you've got are built up over lifetimes. They're deep ingrained habits that one develops by repeated action. So the more you act in a particular way, the more you develop a sort of emotional groove, which means that you're more likely to act that way in the future, given the similar stimulus, if you see what I mean. So if I habitually act, say, with generosity, I set up a habit of generosity that means I'm more likely to be generous in the future. But if I set up a habit of grasping, that will also create a kind of groove in my being, which will mean I'll also be more likely to be a bit stingy in the future. So we have these latent tendencies that we set up over lifetimes. And under the right conditions, they become what's called pariyutana. It's all written on the back, by the way, which means arising all around, which is basically a sort of emotional whirl. And the stimulus that will cause those anusayas to come up into this sort of emotional whirl is friendship and communication. So the anusayas are kind of drawn out. And then become manifest, they become a kind of emotional turbulence, and then they become manifest in actions of body and speech. Incidentally, some people like the Pali, and some people don't. I like the Pali because I think there's more translations and it can give a bit of a poetic, it helps me find different ways of looking at things. But anyway, so the Pali's there if you want it. If you don't want it, don't worry. There's not going to be an exam at the end of the retreat. So basically it means that, in friendship, the anusayas become manifest. The anusayas are seen and And that's a good thing, because then we can deal with them. What can be seen can be worked with. So I'll just say what the anusayas are. The anusayas are, the first one is kama raga, which means desire for sensual gratification. It's wanting pleasure. You know, we don't want uncomfortable situations. We want pleasurable situations. We want pleasant vedana. So on the basic level, we want pleasant vedana, pleasant feeling. The second one is bhava, which means the desire for self-perpetuation, or wanting a sense of sort of completeness or being from someone. Sometimes, and I'll go into this in more depth on the last talk, but sometimes we want a sense of completeness from our friend to sort of reassure ourselves that we exist in a particular way. Or there's patiga, which is grudges, aggression, or predisposition to acts of violence when we don't get what we want. I kind of think about this one as particularly being a bit prickly or defensive. We have an anusaya to send out the thorns, particularly if we're feeling in a challenging situation, or even sometimes to aggression. We've got ditti as an anusaya, which is views or opinions, deeply held views and opinions, usually conditioned by the society in which we live. Things that we think, the way that we view the world, the particular issues that we feel very fond of, that we enable all conversations to come back to that particular issue. So we've got vikikicca, which is doubt, obsessive doubting, diffidence, unwillingness to commit. This is when you're in communication with a friend and suddenly the fog descends. And then you just become a bit vague and can't quite find your way through. Mana, which is comparison or conceit, which manifests in seeing people as either above or fixing yourself in relation to others so that someone's either above, equal or below you. So it's constant, it's with that sort of tendency to comparison all the time. Am I better than them? Am I worse than them? Often people get it where they're just habitually worse than everyone else, which is quite tiring, actually. It's quite tiring to be in that state of mind. Or they think they're better than everyone else. Or they think no one's allowed to be different, we're all the same. And then, you know, there's an investment in that. There's avidya, which is ignorance, or Bhante calls it utilitarian knowledge, that we're sizing everything up in terms of what it can do for us, basically. What does it mean for me? What can I get out of it? Anyway, that's just a flavour of the anusayas, the latent tendencies that come up within communication. And, you know, they're conditioned. It's important to recognise from a Buddhist point of view they're conditioned. And you're not really going to totally get rid of them or transform them until you've seen into the nature of mind itself. And perhaps you don't always need to explain them. You don't need to find the exact conditioning that gave rise to that. Sometimes it's helpful. Sometimes it's good to draw those out and name them. But you need to recognise them as they arise. Ah, this is a conditioned anusaya. It's not me. It's not mine. It's conditioned. And that happens in myself and it happens within my friend. These arise as latent tendencies within consciousness. And it's because they arise in relation to others that it's very useful to be in friendships with people, because you can see them. You can't see them until they come out. This is why we've got the Lojong, or the mind training tradition. It says the people you find difficult with are great friends to you because they're enabling you to work on your anusayas. When I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by wrong deeds and pain, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I'd found a treasure trove. If someone out of envy does me wrong by insulting me and the like, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them. Even if someone who I have helped and in whom I place my hopes does great wrong by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. They have revealed your anusayas. It said that the great proponent of mind training was a teacher, and it said that he was asked to come from India to Tibet. And they were really, you know, the Tibetans loved the teacher. They were so grateful that he came. He actually knew that he was going to shorten his life by 10 years by going to Tibet because it was such difficult conditions. And he came there, and the Tibetan people were so glad and wanted to be helpful. But he had with him a servant that he'd brought with him from India, who just treated him like dirt. He was grumpy and unwilling to help, and rude and insulting. And all the Tibetans were saying, look, just get rid of him. I'll be your servant. You know, it'd be a great honour for me to be your servant. You know, I would learn so much from you, and, you know, I could really help you out. And the teacher was like, no, 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 that servant is my greatest friend. No one is allowed to remove him from his station. So, yeah, so how do we transform the anusayas? Well, in the white rite, the first thing that we do is we practice non-reactivity in the face of difficulty. Shanti, patience. The blue rite, or the black rite, is more about having to take action, but this particular rite is about non-reactivity. It's about not taking it personally with each other. You know, it's not really about you. It's about someone's anusayas that are coming up. It's about someone's tendencies. It feels personal, but often it's not personal. And what we do in the face of our friends and our own anusayas emerging is we undertake beneficial activity. So this is where the Sigalika Sutta comes in. So Sigalika, the Buddha says to Sigalika that we have a friend, the friend who points out what is good, which is atta or arta, which means interest or advantage, blessing, welfare or well-being. So the friend who points out the good is a sort of spiritual welfare, points out what's for your spiritual welfare. And they can be seen to be a loyal friend in four ways. They keep you from wrongdoing. They support you in doing good. They inform you of what you did not know. And they point out the path to paradise. It's written up there. I didn't write it down here. I'm reading it off that, so I might have just got that a bit scrambled. But anyway. So, yeah, so they point out what is good. They point out your spiritual welfare, what helps you to grow and what's of benefit to you. This is very different from just telling people what to do. What it really means is if we're pointing out the way to good with someone is that we're doing it with them. Artacharya or Atacharya, charya means a kind of way of life. I think it's related to the word chariot, sort of movement, like the Bodhicharya Avatara. It's the same word. It means a way of life. And to point out what is good for someone is really following that way of life that is good together. I imagine it more like a kind of path. That if you're walking together and someone's going on the wrong path, you don't just stand there sort of saying, that's wrong, you've got it wrong. You say, it's this way, let's walk together this way. It's that kind of thing. So pointing out the way to good is walking on the way to good together. And in a way, that's more of a way to help each other, is to live the life that we want to lead together rather than just telling other people what to do. In that way, I think one of the best gifts of all to our friends is consistency of practice. I've definitely felt this in my own life of reflecting on what gifts I can give to the world. And I think one of the things that I'm in a way most keen on in myself, I'm not a great spiritual superstar. I don't have magic answers for everyone. But I think what I do know about myself, I don't always say the magic thing, but what I do know about myself is that in all the vicissitudes of life, I come back to my practice. I'm really confident in that. And I think that's a gift to people, that I hope that in 20 years' time, you'll still find me, whatever's going on, I'll still be in a dome on a piece of land, you know, trying to introduce lists of the Pali Canon to people who with varying receptivity. You know, still practicing the Dharma, basically. Still practicing the Dharma. And actually, I have had a bit of a difficult time last year. And one of the things that happened, we were on retreat and Shantavadri decided to introduce me, and which I was a bit self-conscious about. And she introduced me and she just said, one thing I know about Vajratara, she'll keep coming back to her going for refuge. And I was so moved because she was really moved. So then she started crying and then I did. And sometimes, you know, people rejoice in you and I just think, wow, that's such a great thing. That's such a great thing. I'm so pleased that that's one of my qualities. So, yes, so consistency of practice, consistency of walking the path of good, of walking the path of spiritual welfare. And the friend supports, we support each other in doing what is Kalyana, what is beautiful. So it says there, supporting you in doing good. But the word is, again, is Kalyana, supporting you in the beautiful. I think supporting you in the beautiful is much nicer expression. It's not doing it for you. It's supporting you to find the beautiful yourself. It's giving you encouragement, giving each other current encouragement and confidence. And sometimes we have to hold that confidence for our friends. We have to hold that vision of beauty for our friends. Again, like last year when I was finding things quite difficult, and my public preceptor, Ratnadharani, turned to me. We were on some sort of event at Adisthana, and she just turned to me and she looked at me for a long time and she said, "You'll sort it out." And I think her saying that helped me sort it out, because her looking at me like that, saying that with such confidence, was holding confidence in me that I didn't have in myself at that time. She had confidence in my practice, and also she had confidence in the Dharma, that practice works. If you just keep going, it will work. The spiritual life is guaranteed. Sangharaksh has said so. But you don't get any money back. Yes, yeah, so sometimes we have to hold that confidence for each other. There is a spiral path. We are on the spiral path. We have that in us. There is a path to heaven. I quite like it, there being a path to heaven in the Sigalika Sutta. How literally you take that is up to you. I think of what it means is there is a higher life. There is a path to enlightenment. There is a beautiful way of being. There is beauty, spiritual beauty. It could be envisaged as the path to the mystery, or the path to the mythic, or the path to opening imagination and creativity. And we have to keep that sense of the possibility of imagination and beauty and myth and creativity. We have to keep that sense alive in ourselves in order to pass it on to others. There's a story, there's a story in the Pali Canon where someone comes to the Buddha and they said, there are beings and they are stuck in the whirlpool and the ocean and the rush of the river of being. And he just said, tell me where there is solid ground. You can really feel the urgency of this in this sutta. It's the oldest part of the Pali Canon. Tell me where, for me and others, where in this rush of the river of being is there solid ground? And the Buddha says, there is an island. There is an island beyond the reach of death, holding nothing, attached to nothing, people have found this here and now. They are not slaves to Mara. We could say they are not slaves to the Anusayas. So yes, so sometimes we have to take that place of confidence for each other. We have to listen to the things that are stirring up within each other, and we have to communicate to each other about those things, remaining calm, saying there is an island, there is a way, there is beauty in this life. Remaining calm in the face of other people's Anusayas. And I think to do that, we have to also really draw each other out and ask questions rather than giving advice. Sometimes the greatest confidence is just to see that someone else is living that life, is living a life of beauty, and then we know it's possible. And sometimes we need to explore things with each other, draw things out. Sometimes that means helping ourselves and our friends to take moral responsibility for things. So this is also the rite of purification and pacification, is enabling each other to take moral responsibility. It might mean a certain amount of judgment. I know this is the least favourite word possibly ever. But if you look up the word of judgment, it means condemnation, but it also means discernment. Sometimes we have to help each other discern what's ethical and what isn't. So we need that kind of judgment, the discerning kind, rather than the condemning kind. That's the rite of pacification. We don't condemn people. How ridiculous to condemn people, because we're always changing and because we can grow. So, yes, we might have to help each other take discernment in our actions. The Buddha called this quality appamardana, which means sort of ethical heedfulness, enabling a sort of mindfulness. It's a word that's used for mindfulness, but it has that particular tone of ethical heedfulness, making an ethical discernment. And sometimes that means helping each other take the perspective of karma, of actions having consequences. And that is a very profound teaching. I don't think I reflect on karma nearly enough. Nearly enough. It's a very profound teaching. Because what it's saying is what we dwell on, what we act out in body, speech and mind, shapes us in very deep ways. We're conditioning our Anusayas all the time. We're shaping ourselves all the time. In a way, we're sculpting ourselves. And we have the power within us to sculpt something of incredible beauty and harmony, or otherwise. And the way we do that, what we act out on, that we become. It informs our habitual actions, inform the way we see the world, it informs the way we interact with others, it informs the situations that we're drawn to. There's one of the other reflections that I talked about this morning. There's the reflection on us being dependent on others. Another one of the reflections that we need to keep in mind is, of karma I am constituted, or action I am constituted. Karma is my inheritance. Karma is the matrix. Karma is my kinsman. Karma is my refuge. Whatever karma I perform, whatever action I perform, be it good or bad, to that I shall be the heir. Now, it doesn't have to be like, oh no, you know, that is terrible burden or horror. It also can be wonderful. We don't have to think of that as a heavy thing. Sometimes I think of karma as being something kind of metal and heavy, and but actually it's a fluid thing. It's more that karma action is colour and light. We're making of ourselves something beautiful by being here, by engaging with each other, by meditating, by helping each other in the work periods, by discussing the Dharma with people, by trying to practice the precepts, even in the face of difficulty and little sleep and grumpiness, all those things are shaping us, and they're shaping us into quite incredible human beings. So yes, we can, and the way we shape us then informs how we interact with the world, how we view the world, which means that we can live in a place of beauty, and we can live in a place where we invite kindness and we give kindness. We can live in a kind of special magical universe. Yes. So yes, so karma is a very powerful, action is a very powerful tool, and we're creating our future with it. I've got in my notes, I have no idea, be drawn to ancient standing stones and old trees. I'm sure that made sense at the time. But anyway, and maybe that's the kind of world I want to live in. I am drawn to ancient standing stones and old trees. So there's something in that, that I'm creating my future, which is a magical future, in harmony with standing stones and old trees. I live in the place where Henry Vaughan, the great mystical poet of the 17th century, lived. And he has this beautiful poem about how in days of old, every tree had standing under it an angel talking to a man. I think, oh, that's the Pali Canon. And it's Wales and it's Devon. I want to live in that world where underneath every tree is an angel talking to a human. Anyway, right. So yeah, so this requires this kind of discussion and pointing out the way to good. Pointing out what is beautiful, supporting each other in the beautiful, requires confidence in each other as moral agents. It requires helping people to come back to their sensitivity to life, because that's what moral agency really means. It sounds really official, but what it really means is that all human beings are sensitive to life, and really encouraging that sensitivity to life and allowing that to grow. Helping people back to that. In the Mahayana Sutras, this is called bringing people back to their awareness of the roots of good. Bringing them back to their pure motivation. So, yes, in the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra and the Gandavyuha Sutra, it's a very important part of the practice of a bodhisattva to help beings recollect their roots of good. Once people recollect their own roots of good, then they act from the good. That's the kind of purpose of it. So you're not trying to impose goodness on someone. You're not trying to impose ethics on someone. You're helping them to recollect those moments when they had a sensitivity to life, when they had a kind of pure motivation. The word for it is asaya. So sometimes it's called the Kalyana asaya, the pure motivation. We just need to recollect that. You know, sometimes we tell each other our life stories and we talk about those times, perhaps even in childhood, where we saw that there was something, in a way, a transcendent quality. There was a possibility of skillfulness and faith, and a resonance with what's ultimate in the universe. So it's helping people to recollect their asayas. The near enemy of this particular rite is that we can... So this is a near enemy, is what looks like that rite, but isn't that quite. And the near enemy is being so nice to someone that you don't allow their moral reflection. You sort of smother the anusayas that are arising. And in a way, Dada Rinpoche said, maybe it was Sangharakshita. Anyway, I think it might have been Dada Rinpoche said, one of the worst things that you can do to someone is not let them experience the results of their actions. Because if they don't experience the results of their actions, they won't be able to transform those deeper latent tendencies. So yeah, so it's not just about being nice to each other and not challenging each other. The far enemy, of course, though, is being over-directive, overbearing and critical. So we have to remember that we do this journey ourselves. No one can do it for us. We can't do it for our friends, and our friends can't do it for us. There's another part of the Pali Canon where Dotoka comes to the Pali Canon and he bows down at the Buddha's feet and he said, "Oh Buddha, free me from confusion." And the Buddha says, "It's not my place to free anyone from confusion. When you have understood the most valuable teachings, then you yourself will cross the ocean." So that's what we're trying to help in each other in friendships. We have to understand the teachings ourselves. And of course, the most valuable teaching is karma in this context, is that actions have consequences, that we're shaping ourselves and our future all the time. And we can create our own reality through our willed actions. We can make of our lives a paradise, or we can make of our lives a car park. Don't know why that was my vision. Car park's not a terribly exciting place. It's sort of dull, really. Yes, and we don't have to be at the mercy of our latent tendencies, the anusayas. We can help each other with them. We can help each other respond creatively to the anusayas that arise. And that's hard work. It requires patience and it requires forgiveness at every level. Because if you think about it, the depth of the anusayas is greed, hatred and delusion. And we've been doing greed, hatred and delusion forever, for aeons. It's the centre of the wheel of life. And what we're trying to do in the spiritual life is we're trying to put our hand right in the hub of the wheel of life and stop it turning. And that's going to hurt, you know, at some point. This wheel that's been rolling from infinite beginnings is not going to be easy to stop. So I think the rite of pacification is we're going to have to be patient with each other. Don't take it personally. It's just the anusayas arising. So that's perhaps what we can reflect on today. It's just being patient with each other's anusayas.